In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We focus in on the diligent, complex investigative reporting that examined failed oversight and corporate fraud perpetrated by a multi-million dollar biotech startup. The company is called Theranos. Its founder was CEO Elizabeth Holmes. In early 2003, Holmes dropped out of Stanford University and created Theranos after patenting an idea to develop portable blood testing machines that use only a single drop of blood. She rose to success and soon became known as the youngest female billionaire. Despite the deals signed with consumer health companies, federal approval, and raving New Yorker and Forbes articles calling Holmes the next Steve Jobs, there were big problems behind the scenes. Theranos blood test technology was exposed as error-prone and inaccurate by former employees. Some of the employees fearfully reached out to Wall Street Journal reporter John Carreyrou, and he began to investigate. After 3.5 years of tenacious reporting, his recently published book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, now chronicles the hubris and criminal activity that led up to the Theranos crater. John, welcome to Another News.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a powerful read about a very thorough investigation you've done. In general, people like to read about successful underdog businesses, especially college dropouts that suggest a natural intelligence and business acumen, and add in that a woman leads this billion-dollar biotech startup. But that's what the public initially saw. Can you please give listeners a profile on Elizabeth Holmes?
Right. So she was actually the descendant of the Fleischmann's yeast dynasty, which was one of the wealthiest families in America at the turn of the 20th century. And then her great-grandfather and grandfather squandered much of that wealth. And so she was raised with the knowledge that she was from this distinguished, you know, lineage of people who had once been very wealthy and done very well in business. But her father also made sure to teach her about the failings of the younger generations and of his father and grandfather. And the father and mother had high expectations for Elizabeth. And, you know, it's fair to say that there was a decent amount of pressure on her. She got into Stanford, and that was in 2002, and then dropped out after 18 months in 2003 and created her startup, which at first she called Real Time Cures, and later changed the name to Theranos, which, by the way, is a combination of the words therapy and diagnosis. And why is that? Because she had this original vision, which was for a wristband that would have these microneedles that would prick your skin and draw blood and instantly diagnose you with whatever ailed you and then simultaneously inject you with the appropriate drug. Of course, that was really science fiction, and she and her founder pivoted away from that after a few months and tried to do something that was more feasible. And that really became the beginning of a 15-year journey of trying to develop a portable blood testing device that could run the full range of laboratory tests from just a drop or two pricked from a finger.
You explain there are a series of Theranos blood testing machines created in generations. Can you give listeners a snapshot of these products?
Right. So over the 15-year history of the company, there were basically four visions. The first one was the science fiction of the armband that could do everything. Then she pivoted to an attempt at creating a microfluidic device, and it was like a toaster-sized reader with a cartridge that you put into it, and the pinprick of blood went into the cartridge, and the microfluidics at play were in the cartridge. Microfluidics refers to basically the repurposing of the microfabrication techniques that were pioneered by the computer chip industry to move tiny quantities of fluids. And when she dropped out of Stanford in the early 2000s, microfluidics were all the rage. And so she tried to create and tried to develop with engineers a microfluidic system. They kept on banging their heads against the wall, so to speak, and not really getting anywhere with that product. So in late 2007, she abandoned that effort. And that's when a Theranos engineer basically ordered a glue dispensing robot from a company in New Jersey called Fisnar and miniaturized these the components of this glue dispensing robot to create a robot that could test blood and could mimic the steps that a lab scientist does on the bench. And this product became the Edison. And she had a famous Silicon Valley industrial designer design a black and white case for it to hide the kind of rudimentary machinery inside. And that became the Edison. She named it, of course, after Thomas Edison. The thing to know about the Edison is it was limited in its capabilities. It was a device that could only do one class of blood tests, known as immunoassays. And they're these blood tests that use antibodies that bind to molecules to generate a signal to then measure the concentration of a substance in the blood. And the Edison could only do those tests. And there are like three or four other big classes of tests out there that the Edison could not do. So in late 2010, she started overseeing work on the last iteration of the Theranos technology, which she came to christen the Mini Lab, which was going to be a device that could do all the big classes of tests. The thing is, though, that she only started work on the Mini Lab in late 2010, and earlier that year, in fact, very early in 2010, she approached Walgreens and Safeway and asserted to them that she had created this device already and that it could run hundreds of tests off just a drop of blood and that it was ready to go.
What year was this?
This was early 2010. This was a good 9 months before work on the Mini Lab even began. These two retail partners, Walgreens and Safeway, essentially believed her and didn't do much due diligence to speak of and signed these partnership agreements with Theranos. And eventually that led to the rollout of Theranos blood tests in Walgreens stores in September of 2013, at first in Walgreens in Palo Alto and then in about 40 Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area. And at that point, the Mini Lab had been under development for 2.5 years, but it was still a prototype, and it was a prototype that malfunctioned. It didn't work, and it was nowhere near being commercially ready. So what did Elizabeth Holmes do? She and her boyfriend, who by then was the number two at the company, dusted off the older generation device, the Edison, and launched with that. But the Edison was limited, as I said, and really only did about 12 of the tests on this 250-test menu that Theranos advertised. And every other test on that menu was being secretly done with commercial machines bought from third parties, bought from companies like Siemens, and essentially were being done with machines that you could buy off the shelf yourself if you were opening up a laboratory.
By naming one of the blood test machines Edison, it's a reference to that quote about inventing the light bulb. I've not failed. I've found 10,000 ways that won't work. So the implication is the name for Theranos is that they would continue to perfect the blood test machine.
Right, and that's what that's a great insight. In fact, the Theranos engineer who ordered that glue dispensing robot and then used it as the model for what the Edison became presented her with the prototype in the fall of 2007, and she said, "We're going to call it the Edison because everything else we've tried until now has failed." And she said, and he warned her, "Well, this is not ready, you know. I've done a very cursory test to make sure it's not going to electrocute anyone, but under no circumstances should it be used for actual testing of live patients." And she said, that's okay. We're going to iterate. That's a catchphrase that comes back again and again in Silicon Valley. We're going to iterate. We're going to slowly and gradually fix the bugs. And that sort of approach is okay in the computer industry when you're dealing with software, arguably okay also when you're in the internet industry and you're, you know, dealing with smartphone apps and websites. But you can't do that in medicine. You can't put out a buggy prototype in medicine that people are going to rely on to make important health decisions and then say, oh, it's okay, you know, in a couple of years we'll fix that first bug, and then a couple of years after that we'll have the second bug fixed, and eventually we'll get there. If you do that in medicine, you endanger patients' lives.
Which happened.
Which is essentially what happened, because when they went live with the blood tests in Walgreens stores in the fall of 2013, they did two things. So they ran a few of the tests on the Edison, and the Edison, they never scientifically properly validated those tests. So those tests were actually faulty. The Edison's results were not reproducible and were all over the place. And then there was another bucket of about 80 tests where they had hacked these Siemens machines to adapt them to small samples. And one of the ways in which they did that is they diluted the finger stick samples to create more volume, because the Siemens machines were developed to accommodate normal-sized blood samples.
They're the vein.
From the vein, mm-hmm. Right. And when you get your blood drawn from the vein, you usually give several tubes of blood. And so the Siemens machines are built in a way that they have a fair amount of blood in a cup that a probe then goes down in and aspirates.
They hacked the Siemens machines. Were there other machines that they hacked?
The main one that they hacked was called the Siemens Advia 1800, which is a huge machine that's like the size of two office copiers put together. And the two things they did to hack it, the two main things they did to hack it, was one, to dilute the samples to create more volume, and two, to custom manufacture these little cups that were the same as the regular Siemens cups, except they were half the size. And the combination of those two steps resolved the problem known as dead volume, which is that these commercial machines, you have a probe that goes down in the blood sample and it aspirates the blood sample, but usually there's still always a bit of the blood sample that remains at the bottom. By making the cup smaller, they got the bottom of the cup closer to the tip of the probe, and by diluting the sample, they created more liquid. And so they eliminated this problem of dead volume that way. The problem is that when you dilute blood, the Siemens machines, as most blood analyzers do as part of their testing protocols, do a dilution step. So when you're pre-diluting the blood to create more volume, you're double diluting the blood. You're diluting it twice. And when you're doing that, you're creating more opportunity for error because you're tampering with the sample more. The other thing you're doing when you're diluting blood is you're diluting the concentration of the analytes that you're trying to measure in the blood down to levels that the machine hasn't been approved to measure. So the FDA, when it approves these commercial analyzers, approves an analytic range, it's known as. And by diluting the sample, they were diluting the analytes down below the floor of that analytic range, which was crazy. I mean, it was using a machine in a way that it was absolutely not designed to be used, and it was certainly not approved by the FDA to be used.
It's incredible that the employees working at Theranos also thought this was okay to do. And you don't have to be a scientist to know that if you dilute a blood sample from one drop, that you're going to raise or increase inaccurate
increase
results.
The possibility, yeah. Well, one thing I'll say about what you said about the employees is, in the course of reporting the book, I spoke to somewhere between 60 and 70 former employees, and many of them were actually very smart and competent, you know, people with integrity. And I came to realize that the reason Theranos went off the rails is because of the leadership team at the top. It was because of Elizabeth Holmes and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, and the way they ran things. And furthermore, what I would also specify is that a lot of the employees at Theranos didn't know about these shenanigans that were going on in the lab. The company was really operated as these different silos that were cut off from each other, and they were key cards to get into certain parts of the headquarters. And the lab rooms, the doors that led to the lab rooms and the hallway that led to the lab rooms had fingerprint scanners. So unless you were an employee who worked in the lab, you could never access the lab, and you effectively did not know what was going on behind those closed doors.
Okay, so it wasn't just a card where you could give somebody the card and they could check out the lab. It was a fingerprint.
That's right.
Almost like a microchip.
Yeah, I mean, they were obsessed with security. And, you know, of course, they claimed that it was because they were wanting to protect trade secrets, but it's also now clear that what they were also trying to protect were their lies from leaking out and being known to the world.
I think listeners now have a deeper understanding of some of the problems, the product of Theranos, and what's going on with leadership. Now, how did Elizabeth Holmes get people to invest into her idea, and how much in total? That area is a mystery to me, aside from investors having a fear of missing out.
Right. So altogether, if you count the $65 million that Fortress, the New York private equity firm, the loan that it gave Theranos late last year, it's close to $1 billion that was invested in this company over the course of 15 years. But most of that money, the lion's share of that money, was invested after the company rolled out its tests in Walgreens stores. And why am I making that distinction? It's a very important distinction. It's because the investors that invested $700+ million did so because Elizabeth and her boyfriend Sonny came to them and said, look, not only does our product work and do what we say it does, we're already commercial. We're already in Walgreens stores. What more do you need as proof that we're for real? And a lot of investors took that as the validation that they needed to put in the money. And so most of the money, you know, $700+ million of the $1 billion was invested after the fall of 2013. And the huge sums of money that have been revealed recently that were invested by some well-known billionaires such as Rupert Murdoch, who, by the way, controls the Wall Street Journal, or Betsy DeVos, our education secretary, or the Cox family in Atlanta, who control Cox Enterprises, or Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire. All these people put in huge sums of money in 2014 and 2015, and they did so in large part because, to them, you know, it was a no-brainer. It wasn't a startup that had just started and just had a vision. It was a company that was 10, 12 years old and was already commercial. Its product was already rolled out.
It's a great idea.
It is a great vision. I mean, when you also try to figure out how she was able to bamboozle so many people, it would have been a game changer for the diagnostics industry. It's not like Theranos was the first entity to ever have tried to crack this nut. There actually have been thousands of scientists in academia and industry over the past two decades who have tried to figure out how to run many tests off that little blood. And it's a nut that has not been cracked for a couple of reasons. And one of them is different classes of blood tests. So you have one class of blood tests, as I said earlier, is immunoassays. Another is general chemistry assays. Another is hematology tests that do things like counting blood cells. These different classes of tests, they use completely different laboratory instruments and laboratory techniques. And so when you've got your little drop of blood and you do the laboratory techniques that you need to do to test immunoassays, then you've got no sample left to then use the completely different set of laboratory techniques that you need to apply for the general chemistry assays. And no one has yet figured out how to solve that problem, and she and Sonny, her boyfriend, were telling people that they had cracked this nut that no one else had.
Do you think that if Theranos operated with a proper check and balance, that they would have achieved the desired success with their product?
Well, I mean, certainly it would have been a very different trajectory if there had been some sort of oversight, some sort of real oversight. She did almost lose her CEO-ship, as I relate in the book, in the spring of 2008. There had been several incidents where one board member in late 2007 became suspicious of her promises, which were never being realized. And he ended up leaving acrimoniously. His name was Avi Tavanian, and he's actually one of Steve Jobs' best friends. And he had joined the board of Theranos right after retiring from Apple. And then a couple of months later, a new employee who had been put in charge of sales came to the conclusion that Elizabeth was lying to her board about these revenue projections that she was making, and that they could not be reconciled with the state of the technology, which was basically not finished and not ready. And that employee, along with the general counsel, went to the board. At that point, the board met and decided that they needed to bring in some adult supervisions, and they agreed that one of the board members would step in temporarily for 6 months while they looked for a more experienced CEO. And they had Elizabeth waiting outside. They invited her in to tell her about their decision. And as one of my sources explained to me, she then proceeded to change their minds over the next 2 hours. This is how convincing she is. You know, her idol was Steve Jobs, and Walter Isaacson, in his biography of Steve Jobs, coined the term reality distortion field for the way that Jobs was able to make people do what they didn't think they could do. She shares that trait with Steve Jobs. She's able to make people suspend disbelief and do her bidding. She's incredibly persuasive and convincing, and so she averted essentially what would have been a board coup back then in 2008. And after that, her leadership of the company was never threatened again. And in late 2013, she set it up so that the board would never get in her way again by attributing herself 100 votes per share, which effectively gave her 99% of the voting rights of the company. And from that point on, which was December of 2013, the board couldn't even reach a quorum without Elizabeth. If she wasn't there and she didn't agree to a quorum, there was no quorum. The board couldn't do anything without her approval.
Yeah, that sounds like a bad recipe, actually, for good
governance, right? Terrible recipe.
In the recent 60 Minutes piece about Theranos, you're in it. You're doing a lot of media right now since your book Bad Blood has come out. But you call Elizabeth a pathological liar. Can you tell listeners about some of those lies, if you would?
Right. Well, the prologue of the book is basically an anecdote where the CFO at the time, and this is late 2006, learns. He's been at the company 8 months at that point, and he learns from her co-founder that the demos that they've been conducting at Theranos for prospective investors are not completely real. That parts of it are real, but then the actual blood result is pre-recorded. And he had no idea. He'd been bringing around investors for months and getting commitments, funding commitments from them, thinking that these demos were completely real. And so he confronts her later that day and tells her, you know, Elizabeth, we can't do this anymore. You know, this is a line that we can't cross because we're basically misleading people. And she turns icy, her demeanor turns icy, and she says to him, you're not a team player. You need to leave right now. And it's basically evident that she means not just leave my office. She means leave the company right now. And he's fired that day, that very day he's fired.
From productive criticism.
Right, so he ends up leaving as CFO, and the company never replaces him as CFO. The company never has a chief financial officer again because the first one, you know, tried to reason with her that lying was not a good thing. So that's one example, but as you'll see in my book, there are many of them. Another big lie is when she and Sonny go to Walgreens and Safeway in early 2010 and assert that they have technology that can do all these tests off a drop of blood. At that point, they haven't even begun development of the mini lab, not even begun it.
Theranos negotiated contracts with consumer healthcare companies such as Walgreens, the biggest pharmaceutical retail chain in the country. Can you talk about that deal and the former Walgreens CFO?
Right. I mean, that's one of the most incomprehensible parts of this whole Theranos story is how did Walgreens not do its due diligence and not figure out that the Theranos technology was not ready? And the answer is in one of the chapters in my book, Chapter 7, we learned that Walgreens did hire a lab consultant in 2010 to vet Theranos and its claims, and his name is Kevin Hunter. And he even traveled to Palo Alto to visit the company with Walgreens executives several times and sat in on meetings and on weekly video calls and pretty quickly became suspicious about the company's claims. You know, at one point, Sonny and Elizabeth came to Chicago to the Walgreens headquarters and did a little demo of the black and white Edison machines and then wouldn't give, in the ensuing weeks, wouldn't give back to Walgreens the test results. Elizabeth also wouldn't agree to do a comparison study that Kevin Hunter was suggesting they do involving 50 patients comparing results from Stanford Hospital to Theranos. Elizabeth refused that. He had also suggested that one of his colleagues at his firm, which was called Collaborate, be embedded with Theranos in the lead up to this pilot partnership. And Theranos refused that. Eventually, Sonny and Elizabeth asked that this guy, Kevin Hunter, be excluded from all meetings between the companies and from their weekly video calls because they found the questions that he was asking were hostile, and they claimed that he was getting in the way of getting things done. And he pleaded with Walgreens to not let them have their way. And Walgreens turned him down and did exclude him because Walgreens had this tunnel vision, which was that it was obsessed with its competition with its larger rival based in Rhode Island called CVS. And it was paranoid that if it did anything to turn off Theranos, that Theranos would break off the relationship and go and do a partnership with CVS. So they had this fear of missing out.
Again.
And the fear of missing out resulted in Walgreens ignoring its own consultant and not doing its proper or the proper amount of due diligence it should have done.
It's a huge lesson.
It is. I mean, it's due diligence when you're talking about business deals and you're talking about partnerships or you're an investor and you're investing in companies, it's very important to do your research to verify claims, especially when you're dealing with science and you're dealing with medical research, you know?
Speaking of science, why is it noteworthy to understand that Holmes is a college dropout and she doesn't have a background in science or medicine?
Right. Well, that's actually one of the first things that made me suspicious about her whole story. I read a profile of her in The New Yorker in December of 2014, and that was actually the first story that put her on my radar. She had become famous in the preceding year, but I hadn't heard of her until that story, and I thought it was fishy that a college dropout who had just two semesters of chemical engineering under her belt actually pioneered groundbreaking new medical science. You know, it's conceivable, and it's even been done that dropouts create products that involve software. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is one example of that. He learned to code on his dad's computer when he was 10 years old with basically a coding manual. And, you know, several decades before him, Bill Gates did the same thing. They were, you know, self-taught coders. You can do that with computer programming. You can't do that with medicine. I mean, this is not a field in which you can go without formal training. You have to have the formal training and the knowledge, and then you got to do years of research to add value. There's a reason that most Nobel scientists win the Nobel in their 60s. It's because it's taken them a career's worth of work to get to that breakthrough that changes things and that advances medicine.
Can you give listeners an idea of how important it is for doctors to evaluate accurate blood test results for their patients?
Right. Well, this is one of the things that Elizabeth used to say at the height of her fame, and she was right. Doctors rely on blood tests for 70% of their health decisions. For the 70% of the medical decisions that doctors make are based on blood tests. So blood tests are absolutely integral to the care of patients in our modern society. And as a result, you have to have accurate blood tests. The two dominant companies in this space are Quest and LabCorp, and they operate a virtual duopoly in blood testing, and you can certainly criticize them for that. But what you probably can't criticize them for as much is the accuracy of their testing. They put a lot of resources into getting the testing that they do every day and every night correct.
Were patients put at risk from inaccurate blood test results from Theranos?
Absolutely. By the time I started digging into the company, they had gone commercial with the blood test, not just in Palo Alto, but in the Phoenix area and some 45 stores for a year and a half. And tens of thousands of patients had been tested. Tens of thousands more, by the way, were tested during the course of my investigation because it took me 9 months to get my first front page story published. So when all was said and done, Theranos voided or corrected almost 1 million blood test results and reimbursed every single one of the nearly 80,000 customers whose blood it tested in Arizona.
And you went down there to speak with some of the doctors who were involved with the Theranos blood testing and some that were not, just to do your own testing.
That's right. I went there in the spring of 2015, and I found a handful of doctors who were sending their patients to Theranos Wellness Centers inside Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area. And I quickly found instances of questionable results where, you know, patients had come back with results that were abnormally high or abnormally low, and then the doctor would send them to another lab to check. Invariably, the results from the other lab would come back normal. One of the cases that I chronicled in the book was this woman who got her Theranos results back on the eve of Thanksgiving. I believe it was 2014, and she had six or seven values that were in the critical range, and her doctor became very concerned. And she had the main symptom that she had was ringing in her ear, and when the doctor looked at the blood test results and put them next to the symptoms, she thought maybe this patient is on the cusp of a stroke. So she sent her immediately to the emergency room. The patient ended up spending 4 hours in the hospital and got all manner of scans. And eventually her blood was retested by the hospital's lab, and the values came back normal. And in the end, the ringing in the patient's ear was just because, you know, she had recently come back from a three-week trip to Europe, and she was jet-lagged and tired. And that's really all it was.
It's a great example of how extremely problematic this could be. And again, it supports what you were saying. This is not a piece of software here. You're dealing with people's lives, and accuracy matters. And for some reason, it wasn't a priority for – it appears that it wasn't a priority for Theranos. John, I wanted to give listeners a better understanding of who Elizabeth Holmes is, despite the profile that you've put out there about her. I suspect listeners are thinking, what kind of influence and persuasive capabilities does this woman have? And, well, she's got very large eyes. She does blink. I've seen her blink.
Occasionally,
there is something hypnotic about her, but you had pointed out something about her voice, that it was an affectation.
Right. So one of my sources for the book worked at Theranos for a year, and shortly after he joined, he was meeting with her in her office in Palo Alto, and it was toward the end of a long day, and they were concluding the meeting, and she was excited. And she got up from her chair and told him how excited she was that he was there, and momentarily slipped out of her baritone, and suddenly he heard this much more natural-sounding young woman's voice that was several octaves higher. And he realized at that point that she was putting on the deep voice. As he thought about it, it made sense to him because Silicon Valley was then and still really is now a man's place. It's, you know, you look at the ranks of venture capitalists, there are very few women. You look at the famous startup founders, there aren't really any women. I mean, there are two women I can think of who have become well-known in Silicon Valley, Marissa Mayer and Sheryl Sandberg, and neither of them founded their own company. They were early employees at Google. Sandberg is now the number two at Facebook. But they were the hired help. They didn't create their own companies. So it's a man's world. And this ex-employee concluded that she must have decided that to be taken seriously in this man's world, she needed to have a man's voice.
It does sound out of place, but we're just not used to hearing that.
Right. I mean, he's not my only source on that. You know, one of her best friends in college is a character in the book and told me that Elizabeth's voice was much higher in college when she was 18, 19 years old. I've spoken to family members as well who say that the voice is a put-on. So there are multiple sources on that, and it's not just conjecture.
Let's hear a short clip of Elizabeth Holmes speaking at the Pan IIT 2015 Global Leadership Conference.
At the end of the day, when we look back at our lives, I've always believed nothing matters more than knowing you've done something to make this world a better place. And I believe that each of us do that, make a difference, by giving our gift, doing what you love to do. Because when you find what you love, no matter how hard it gets, you keep going because you love it. So I thought this morning I'd take time to share some principles that inspire me and guide me as I work to live a purposeful life and to realize our mission at Theranos, which is to make actionable health information accessible for everyone as a basic human right. The first thought I want to share is about taking time to think about what it is you'd do if you knew you could not fail, and doing what you're afraid to do. When that happens, it's amazing what we can do and how many people want to walk and work with us. Leadership, to me, is about committing everything to a cause that serves people and guiding a team to realize that vision all the way through. Any great cause can only be realized by a team of people believing in making the impossible possible.
It's interesting now to hear a speech like this, and this was back in 2015, knowing what you know now.
Right. I mean, she often gave these inspiring speeches on the face of it where she said, you know, things like, what would you do if you knew you could not fail? Or, I failed 1,000 times and I just keep getting up, trying again. You know, a lot of these sort of bromides were canned. In fact, the one about, you know, what would you do if you knew you could not fail was inscribed on a long paperweight that she must have bought at one point in the early days of the company, and she had it on her desk facing her. I guess she found it inspiring, but she didn't even coin that one.
On this show, we go into a lot of detail on certain psychological theories such as the human shadow, and many years ago we started looking at psychopathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured there is an interest here by the public into that aspect of the CEO of Theranos. And I thought, well, I'll look up some of the traits here on the Hare psychopathy checklist. I wanted to go through just a couple of these. And the first one is pathological lying. We'll check that one off because you already mentioned it and we discussed that. Glib and superficial charm, a grandiose sense of self.
That one definitely applies.
Need for stimulation, cunning and manipulative.
I think that one, if you read my book, I think you see that that one applies too.
Lack of remorse or guilt.
That one has to apply because she has to this day not admitted wrongdoing or made any attempt at apologizing to patients or to investors or to the public. So I would say for sure that one applies.
Shallow emotional response, callous and lack of empathy.
That one goes hand in hand with, not feeling any guilt.
And not seeing the potential harm an inaccurate blood test would have for patients.
Right. I don't know if she ever stopped to think about who she was really, who the customer really was. The end customer is a patient, and the end customer is relying on your service to inform their medical care. And did she ever really empathize with those patients? She said that she did. She paid lip service to that notion, but I don't think she ever really did.
All right, so the list goes on. Parasitic lifestyle, poor behavioral controls, sexual promiscuity, early behavior problems, lack of realistic long-term goals.
Yeah, I don't know if that one applies because I think Elizabeth Holmes was voraciously ambitious, and her ambition was to become a tech billionaire. When she was 9 or 10, a relative asked her the question every boy or girl is asked, which is, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she replied immediately, I want to be a billionaire. And the relative said, you're sure you don't want to be president? And she said, no, the president will marry me because I'll have $1 billion. So rich and fame were a goal, and they were a goal from an early age.
That she achieved.
Wealth and fame, I'm sorry. Being rich and famous.
Mm-hmm. And she achieved it.
And she achieved it for a period of several years.
Impulsivity, irresponsibility, failure to accept responsibility.
Those last two, I think, would go hand in hand with the lack of empathy, lack of remorse.
And they didn't admit wrongdoing despite the fines, the SEC fine.
Right. There has never been any admission of wrongdoing. I mean, essentially, for the past 2.5 years, Theranos has been spending what's left of investor funds on paying lawyers and on litigating. By my calculations, based on the money that they spent in 2016 on lawyers, which was $60 million, I think they've now spent more than $200 million just on lawyers, and that doesn't even include the settlements, the quiet out-of-court settlements that they've reached with the likes of Partner Fund Management, that San Francisco hedge fund that invested $96 million. Theranos paid Partner Fund $43 million in a quiet settlement in the spring of 2017. It paid Walgreens about $30 million in a quiet settlement. It paid Arizona $5 million. And it recently reached a settlement with the SEC, and there's never been really any admission of wrongdoing. I think the big question now is whether the U.S. Attorney's Office, which has been conducting a criminal investigation into these events, is going to charge her.
That'll be interesting. Do you know if there's a timeline on that?
I don't know what the timeline is, but I know that the investigation's been going on for 2.5 years and that it's well advanced. And my sources tell me it's likely to result in criminal charges.
Can you give listeners an idea of what interference you've gone through in how Theranos responded to your reporting in the Wall Street Journal and now Bad Blood?
Right, so I first approached, or rather Theranos learned that I was digging into the company in April of 2015, which is actually the week that I was in Arizona talking to doctors. And I was a few days away from going to it to start confronting it with what I had unearthed. For the next 2 months, they gave me the runaround. Essentially, they hired this outside PR person who just gave me the runaround. And finally, I lost patience. It was surreal. She was continuing to give interviews to virtually every other media organization under the sun, appearing on TV, being a fixture at conferences, and it seemed like the only journalist she wouldn't speak to was me. So I got angry and I said to the PR guy, you know, you guys can't keep ignoring me. You have to address my questions, which is when they went from the strategy of ignoring me to the strategy of fighting me. At that point, you know, it escalated pretty quickly. David Boies, the famous lawyer who was Theranos' outside counsel, came to our offices with a group of his associates and met with us in a conference room for 5 hours and did everything he could to persuade us to drop the story. In the ensuing days and weeks, Theranos started surveilling some of my confidential sources, including one source who has now gone on the record and identified himself, Tyler Schultz, who happens to be the grandson of George Schultz, the former Secretary of State, who was on the Theranos board. Theranos figured out that he was one of my sources and put enormous pressure on him, essentially ambushed him with two Boies-Schiller lawyers in his grandfather's house in May of 2015, and tried to get him to sign a statement essentially recanting what he had told me and naming other journal sources. And thankfully, Tyler withstood that pressure campaign for months by standing firm, enabled me to go to press in October of 2015 with my first story.
You know, your book is about your investigative work, and it's important investigative journalistic work that you've done, but it wouldn't have happened, as you mentioned, had it not been for the employees with conscience coming forward. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I mean, to me, they're the heroes. I'm not the hero. I am the vehicle for their heroism, but they are the ones who took the risks to their careers. They took legal risks because Theranos, you know, threats of litigations were always in the air when you work there. And Elizabeth had sued employees in the early days, ex-employees in the early days of the company. Sonny Balwani, her boyfriend, was constantly threatening and intimidating people. And David Boies was the lawyer, and he was a scarecrow. And he put the fear of God in people who work there and prevented them from speaking out while they were at the company and after they left. And so these whistleblowers who were willing to become confidential sources, they took tremendous risks, and I am forever grateful for their courage and for their integrity.
When they were attacking you, I mean, there were some childish things that happened. They were chanting F you. They had that game, which is a funny video on the Wall Street Journal where you're playing the game on the laptop.
Right. The thing to know about the sort of, I call it a scorched earth campaign to suppress my reporting and to intimidate my sources. It continued after publication of the first story. And in fact, 2 days after publication of that first story, in October of 2015, Elizabeth and Sonny held an all-employee meeting in the cafeteria of the Theranos headquarters on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto. Elizabeth gave a defiant speech about how my stories were completely factually wrong and scientifically erroneous and seeded by disgruntled employees and competitors who were trying to trample Theranos and prevent it from changing the world.
Now, I might jump in here and say that people who were hearing both sides of the story were still a little confused. They would want to believe Elizabeth, and you could easily be characterized as somebody that was angry and going after them.
And right, and that was their game plan at mm-hmm. that point, was to really push back, to paint me as this rogue reporter who'd gotten his facts wrong, and to threaten me and threaten the Wall Street Journal with litigation. And it got to a point in that meeting 2 days after my first story where it was Sonny's turn to sort of take to the lectern, and he led everyone in the cafeteria in a chant of F U Carrie Rue, F U Carrie Rue.
It's juvenile.
It happens to rhyme. Yeah. It has a certain ring to it, I have to admit.
Also the game. Can you tell us
that was actually I came to have in my possession a copy of the game because the former Theranos employee who created that game reached out to me. He no longer works at the company, nor does he any longer think that the company was legitimate. At the time that he made that game, it was the spring of 2016. He worked in Theranos' manufacturing facility in Newark, California, which is across San Francisco Bay from Palo Alto. He was among those people who didn't know about the shenanigans in the lab and who still hoped the employer he worked for was being unfairly attacked. And so during the President's Day holiday, he created this game and had it displayed at this sort of company party they had. You know, various employees sat down and played it. And basically, it's a version of Space Invaders for those of you born before 1980 who remember the Atari game. The invaders were my head that was dropping down, and the machine gun at the bottom shooting was the mini lab device, Theranos' mini lab device, and the bullets that it was shooting at my head were its little nanotainer vials filled with blood.
The one drop of blood.
Right.
Yeah.
And the game was called Haters Will Be Haters, as in Carrie Rue and the Wall Street Journal are haters. They're just biased, and they have this preconception about us. And I personally call the game Space Invaders Theranos Edition.
Now, financially, a lot of money was lost. The investors lost millions and millions of dollars here.
Hundreds of millions of dollars. Almost $1 billion was wasted on this company.
Who were some of the big losers?
Well, the single biggest investor as an individual was Rupert Murdoch, the owner, controlling shareholder of the Wall Street Journal and of many other media assets. He put in $125 million. Betsy DeVos's, our education secretary's family, put in $100 million. The Coxes of Atlanta, who control the media and telecom and auto conglomerate, Cox Enterprises, put in another $100 million. The Walton family, through two separate firms, put in $150 million. Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire, put in $30 million. Partner Fund Management, a hedge fund based in San Francisco, put in $96 million. A Greek shipping heir put in $25 million. The Oppenheimer Diamond Dynasty of South Africa put in $25 million. Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, put in $1 million.
This is just off the top of your head. Listeners, he's not reading anything.
No, no.
I was talking about Theranos and, you know, the implosion with a family member, and the first thing they said was this, is this money laundering? Did that ever cross your mind?
Right. So some people, when I've discussed Theranos, it always obviously comes up in my life, and some people have speculated that it was like a Ponzi scheme, and it wasn't actually technically a Ponzi scheme because it's not like she was taking in new money and then using it to repay early investors. The money was staying inside the company and getting spent. Mm-hmm. But her game was to keep raising money. And in fact, I've seen the investment documents that she gave Rupert Murdoch in late 2014, shortly before he invested. You know, the cover letter refers to Theranos being a long-term investment and staying private for the long term no fewer than 17 times. So she had no plan on going public. She did not have any desire to go to the public markets and to become a publicly traded company. And for good reason, because, you know, once you do that, then you have to start putting out quarterly reports and you have to start putting out annual reports, basically do all these disclosures that you don't have to do when you're a private company.
Will you continue to report on the actions of Theranos?
Oh, of course. I mean, there are two things right now that I'm watching for that I expect to happen at some point in the next few months. One is that the company goes bankrupt. In an email to investors last month, Elizabeth said that at the rate at which they were spending money, they would go beneath $3 million in cash by late July, at which point the covenants of the loan agreement with Fortress, the private equity firm that loaned the money last year, allow Fortress to seize the company's assets and to liquidate them. So we're likely looking at a liquidation of Theranos in August, and Theranos is likely to have ceased existing in August. The other big development that I'm watching out for is the conclusion to the U.S. Attorney's criminal investigation. My understanding from my sources is that they're close to finishing the investigation and that they are going to bring criminal charges. I would be surprised if we don't hear an outcome about an outcome to that investigation in coming months.
Do you think what happened to Martin Shkreli could happen to Elizabeth?
Well, there are actually many observers who have opined that what Elizabeth Holmes did was far worse than what Martin Shkreli did. Martin Shkreli actually reimbursed his investors. You know, what was so despicable about Shkreli was his public persona. And I think he antagonized prosecutors, federal prosecutors, by taunting them. And that was a big part of why they came down on him so hard. But there are many people who would argue that defrauding investors of more than $700 million and putting patients in harm's way and lying to federal officials and lying to regulators and lying to the public, that all of that body of work, so to speak, amounts to much worse than what Shkreli did. If prosecutors bring criminal charges against Holmes and Balwani, I think it will be a big shot across the bow in Silicon Valley that this type of behavior, just because you're an entrepreneur and that your company is private, will not be tolerated. That your company may be private, but you still have to obey the same rules that we all abide by in society, and that ultimately you can't commit fraud.
I've read that there will likely be a movie coming out about Theranos.
Yeah, you're right. The movie rights have been optioned by Legendary Entertainment, a Hollywood studio. Adam McKay, who directed The Big Short, the movie about the financial crisis, is attached to direct. Jennifer Lawrence is attached to play Elizabeth Holmes, and they just hired Vanessa Taylor, who co-wrote the screenplay for The Shape of Water with Guillermo del Toro, which just recently won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. They just hired Vanessa to write the Bad Blood screenplay.
Wow. Do you think you'll be consulted?
I have a consultant role on the movie, yes. And I intend to help them as much as I can because I would like this to be a good movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's an important story. It's a parable of unchecked ambition and greed in Silicon Valley, in this enormous ecosystem that's grown out there over the past 10 years of these unicorn companies, these so-called unicorns, which refers to these companies that have valuations of $1 billion or more. You know, these young founders that head them without really any checks and balances on them, which, as we've come to learn with Theranos, leads to excesses and to wrongdoing.
Indeed. John Carreyrou, author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guest.